To the first introductory series that we'll be teaching here now in our new center in Redwood City. And it's a 5-week series, and series builds on itself, where I will be giving the basic instructions for mindfulness meditation in our particular tradition. And it starts the first day today talking about meditation posture and the basic meditation on breath and breathing. And that then is the foundation for next week talking about mindfulness of the body. And in fact, mindfulness of the breath is a subset in Buddhism of mindfulness of the body. And mindfulness of the body being embodied in our experience, having an embodied awareness, is maybe unparalleled in importance for the rest of Buddhist spirituality. Everything else kind of builds in a healthy way, being discovering how to live through and in our body. And then the following 3rd week, it's mindfulness of emotions, an important part of everyone's lives, and how to bring that into the field of mindful awareness. And then the 4th week, we'll be talking about our cognitive world, the thoughts, and how to include thoughts as part of our meditative experience, meditative engagement with life. And then the 5th week, we'll talk about how to integrate the mindfulness practice into the rest of our lives, how it all comes together. I'll be teaching the first 4 weeks. And then in February, I go away to teach a month-long retreat. And so the 5th week will be taught by one of our most senior students here, who's taught these kind of courses on, by herself, Carolyn Dilley, will come up and do that. And that's the plan. The these talks get taped by Allison, because some people, like, if they miss a class, they like to get a copy of the class they missed, or just like to have a series or whatever. And you can talk to Allison up here if you'd like to, at some point, to get copies of them. The class is offered on a donation basis. And in fact, part of the religious or spiritual values of the Buddhist tradition, the Theravadan Buddhist tradition that we teach within, one of the most important values is that of generosity and offering the teachings and the practice opportunity freely to people and letting the teachings unfold in a field of generosity where things are freely given. And so as we've moved into this building, one of the decisions that we as a group has made is that activity will be offered here that there's ever a fee for. Everything in this building will be offered in our traditional spiritual sense of everything we offered on a donation basis. And occasionally we might, in some events we have a suggested amount, but still the spirit is that of donation. People who come here can freely participate in that as they wish. What it means is that for this introductory course, or for most of our activities, we'll have 2 baskets by the door. One basket says teacher donation, or teacher dana. The word dana means donation in Pali. And and that's a donation to me. And my livelihood comes from, that's my livelihood, is from the donations I get this way. And then the other donation basket is for our operating expenses. For now we have a center, we have a building, and various things we have to pay for. And that's the same system we've had in the past. In the past, we had to pay for rent, the places we used. And here we have to pay for our own place. So there's these 2 donation baskets. If everyone donated $1 or $2 for the operations, I think that would be a comfortable amount for our group. So that's kind of more or less a suggested amount. You're welcome to do more. And the suggested amount for the teacher dana would be $10 each class. And that's for you to do as you wish with that. That's just a ballpark. You know, that's not even a ballpark. That's just whatever it is. So I think that's all I have to say logistically. So my name is Gil Fronsdal, and I've been the teacher for our group for 11 years, since 1990, when I came to Stanford to be a graduate student in Buddhist studies. And I spent many years as a Buddhist monk here in this country and in Japan and in Southeast Asia, Thailand and Burma. And then was trained extensively in the Zen tradition of Buddhism. And then when I went to Southeast Asia, was trained then in the Theravadan tradition, which is the tradition of this center here and how we teach here. And in 1989, I was invited to become, to train with Jack Kornfield to become a Vipassana teacher. And so then I went through a four-year training with him at the same time that I was beginning to teach for the sitting group in Palo Alto, which then slowly grew over the years. And now we're here in our own place. So I think that's what I have to say for introduction. Maybe I should ask you all, how many of you are new to meditation who came here tonight? And how many of you, how many are new to mindfulness meditation, have some meditation background, but not insight meditation? Anyway, so welcome to all of you. The word, the Pali, the Buddhist word for what we teach here is vipassana. And vipassana literally means something like clear seeing, to see clearly or see in a special way. And so we get to the word insight. It's an insight practice. Many Westerners are then confused because many of us think of insight as being psychological insight. If I somehow do some kind of introspection, I'll discover, you know, that the reason why I always slur my S's is because when I was 3 years old, I saw a snake. You know, that's the reason I get this insight into why I'm doing certain things. And that kind of insight is very important. And that kind of insight can come from insight meditation. In fact, it often, you can expect that any kind of effort, any practice of paying attention carefully to yourself will reveal many of the patterns that govern our lives and run us and cause our stress and many things. From a Buddhist point of view, the insight of insight meditation is not into what's personal, the personal nature of our biography and what influenced us, but is insight into what's universal. The universal aspects, some people would call it transpersonal, or that which is spiritual opposed to, for example, what's personal. If you can just, I don't want to make a sharp distinction, but. So it's the ability to be able to sit still and quiet and train the mind or cultivate the mind so the mind can be used to develop a contemplative or insightful or meditative, receptive mode of being, of what our experience is in the present moment. Most of us will find, if you pay attention, don't spend much time in the present moment at all, unless we're really forced to because events are quite dramatic. Or we're in the present moment because sometimes it's very easy to be in the present moment if you're watching television. If you can have the same attention for your meditation as you do watching television, we'd all be enlightened pretty quickly. But, you know, you're very focused and relaxed, and your mind doesn't wander too much, I suppose. But to sit down and have the mind pay attention, to be alert, relaxed, open, and in the present moment, without something out there which has captivated our attention, is unusual for most people. It's almost as if our growing up and our experience of society has trained us not to be that way. And the mindfulness practice is a retraining of ourselves, of our capacity to be alert and relaxed and present, receptive, of what's actually happening in the present moment. So a lot of what happens in most spiritual life, I think, a lot of it, especially meditative one, is very similar, whether you do mindfulness or Zen or prayer or other things. Initially, a lot of it is just working with our own tendencies to get caught up in thinking about the past, about the future, about fantasy, to get lost in our desires, to get lost in our aversions and angers, for the mind to be anywhere but settled in a relaxed, open way to what's happening in the present. So coming to terms about dealing with that is a common spiritual issue in many traditions. And it's an issue for us as we do mindfulness practice. What does it take to learn to let go or not be captivated by all the places the mind goes, so that the mind can, in a sense, rest or be settled or be strong, be present for life as it's actually lived? I was, about a year ago, I realized that I had become very fond of looking at old photographs. And the older the better, yes, in terms of photographs, but photographs of people. So 100 years old, 120 years old or something. And I'd always go look really closely at the faces of these old photographs. And after, so I got interested. Why am I so interested in these photographs, of old photographs? And I realized that I was most interested in looking at their facial expressions, and especially at their eyes. Because every once in a while, I come across a photograph from 100, 150, 120 years ago, whatever, a long photograph, and there'd be a kind of a glimmer in the eyes of life, of alertness, of consciousness. And often I look at the face, and there'd be all kinds of different expressions. Some people look happy, some people look sad, some people looked resigned to their lot, some people looked optimistic, some people were sometimes like this kind of cocky, happy-go-lucky kind of face. And there'd be all these kind of like emotional expressions there, you know, highlighted in some little glint in some people's eyes. And of course, the backdrop for this was that these people are long dead. And so I look at these photographs, and I would realize that was their moment to be alive. That was their moment of being with their lived experience. And the reason I was so interested in these photographs is that it became a mirror for me to remind me to take conscious interest in my lived experience right now. Because this is my moment. Right now is our moment, your moment. You have a certain lot of time to be alive, and it's something very special and precious, the glint in your eyes, or the expression, the emotional expression you have, or your attitude towards life, and your lived experience. And it's all too easy to lose track of our lived experience by wandering off into fantasy, or being in the past, or being caught up in what if only. My favorite definition of forgiveness is giving up all hope for a better past. So we spend a lot of time hoping for a better past, maybe, or hoping for a better future. But there's something very precious about the lived moment right now. And this is something that contemplative, monastics, spiritual people down through the ages have appreciated a lot. And why sometimes they go out and spend time in nature, why they go spend time in monasteries, go on retreats, is to really highlight something very simple, but something which is often lost to us as we run around living busy lives or preoccupied lives caught up in our concerns. And that is the simplicity and the delight of this very moment when we've entered into a mindful living of it, when we're living it mindfully, consciously, contemplatively, when the fullness of who we are right now reveals itself. So mindfulness, vipassana, is a very simple practice. There's nothing that's particularly Buddhist about it, even though Buddhists like to do it. It's developing a capacity we all have, and that's the capacity to pay attention, to be aware. And rather than taking awareness as just a kind of given that can't be changed or that's from a Buddhist point of view, our awareness is something like a muscle that can be developed and strengthened. And what's interesting about developing and strengthening a muscle is that, I don't know so much about physiology and how these things work, but so maybe I'm wrong here, but sometimes if you really want to have a muscle be deeply relaxed and at ease, it's really good for it to be well-toned. You need to have certain strength in a muscle to let it also to relax. So whether that's true or not, that's the principle with awareness. We want to both develop it as a capacity of the strength, like a muscle, but also we want to discover a capacity to have it very relaxed and at ease. And there's a play in Buddhist spirituality between developing these two in a balanced way, developing a strength of mind, of heart, and also develop a very relaxed, receptive mode of being. So it's a capacity we all have just to be pay attention. In our practice, we want to develop that capacity and make it a more useful part of our lives. So I hope you understand that we're not... So what I'm going to offer here for these 5 weeks is a Buddhist practice offered to you without any necessity to accept any of the Buddhist part of it. You can just kind of let that kind of just go right in ear, one ear, not the other. You hear the word Buddhism, you can just, you know, it's not necessary. What I'm saying is that's not necessary for the practice itself. You might appreciate what Buddhism has to say. But really what we're doing here is learning how to cultivate awareness of our lived experience moment by moment. The Buddhist point of view about this is you live a wiser, more compassionate, more loving, less conflicted life if you've learned how to be and remain in the present moment in our lived experience. If you live in the past, in the future, in fantasy, it's a much easier to get caught up in conflict with ourselves and the world around us. So it's very simple, simply a capacity to pay attention. So if just without even moving your posture right now, just staying as you are, if you just closed your eyes, what was the first thing you become aware of? You simply become aware of your experience right now. And then as you're aware of your own experience, is there judgment about it? Interpretation? Is there any attitude about it? Is it possible to just leave your experience alone as it is? With no judgment, no interpretation, no attitude. Keeping your eyes closed, I want to say that attention, awareness of our experience is very, very simple. And maybe this next exercise will point to this. As you're sitting here, stop paying attention. No more paying attention. Please stop being aware. Okay, so you can open your eyes. So what happened? Could you stop paying attention? What happened when you tried to? Sorry? You relaxed some, good. Did you succeed in not paying attention? Oh, well, yeah, you're ready to fall asleep. Were you aware that you were doing that?
Yeah.
What I try to point in this exercise, to both these exercises, is how simple awareness is. And it's helpful to be reminded of the simplicity of this practice. One of my teachers in India, he was fond of saying, be simple, 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 until my travel checks were stolen in Calcutta. And then he said, yes, but don't be a simpleton. The other thing I want to say about mindfulness practice is that it's a practice which applies to formal meditation practice as well as applies to everyday activity, to be mindful as we go about in our activity. And as I do this 5 weeks, probably what will happen is I'll slide back and forth, and it won't always be obvious whether I'm still talking about meditation, like formal meditation, sitting meditation, or talking about mindfulness in daily life. And that's because for me, there is no sharp divide between those two worlds. And I would feel I feel like I hadn't done my job well if by the end of this 5 weeks you thought mindfulness was only something to be done as a meditation practice itself, even though it's quite powerful there. But as a meditation practice, it helps to have a good upright posture. Posture is a very helpful, it's not a necessary foundation for meditation, but it's a very helpful one. And so I want to spend a few minutes talking about a basic meditation posture that try to help you find one that maybe works for you. Classically, the idea is to sit cross-legged on the floor. You don't have to sit on the floor. There's some pragmatic benefits to being on the floor. One of them is that having your center of gravity really low to the floor seems to make it easier for the body to relax. Also, sitting on the floor cross-legged gives you a tripod effect with the two knees and the butt, and so it's more stable than sitting in a chair, for example. You don't have that tripod kind of effect. And there's a greater stability for holding yourself upright for the duration of the sitting. One of the more universal principles of posture is it's very helpful, if you can, to avoid using a backrest when you're meditating. Some people have to use it, and it's fine in that case. But even if you're sitting in a chair, if your back allows for it, to sit away from the backrest so your back is self-supporting. An important part of developing this muscle of mindfulness is to become self-reliant in an inner way, some kind of inner self-reliance as part of the process. It's easier to discover that if the body is also self-reliant. The body and the mind are very closely connected. So to sit out from the chair. So I'll first say a few words about sitting on the floor. And then I'll talk about the chair. I actually recommend that people don't sit cross-legged in the sense of crossing the legs, but they sit with one leg, they sit so-called cross-legged, sit the Burmese fashion or Taylor fashion with one leg in front of the other. So both feet are on the floor, not crossing at all, like this. Kind of get the idea? And that puts the least amount of torque on the knees and the ankles and the hips, and it's a little bit easier for people to sit then. And then it's best to sit on, to elevate yourself when you're sitting. And if you sit elevated by sitting on a cushion, then it helps get the knees down. It tips the pelvis forward a little bit so that you can get your knees down, because some people really tighten their hips and it's hard to get their knees down unless they sit upright a little bit. Also, sitting up on something helps create a little bit of a guarantee that you have a little bit of maintain the natural curve or a little bit of an extra curve, teeny bit, in the lower part of your back, because you want to maintain the natural curve there, because then it's a lot easier to keep your back upright for the duration. If your back is flat, your lower back, or it's caving out, you'll strain your back over time. So there's a variety of ways of sitting on a cushion. There's two extra cushions on the back platform in the corner, I believe. And if anyone doesn't have one, wants to try it, then there's a couple there. So on the round cushions, the idea is to sit on the front third, or so, front half. So you kind of, there's kind of a slope on it, it's kind of in the front slope. And but you can also sit on these half moons. Some people find these more comfortable because they spread out the weight of the body, for some people better. And you can also sit on a bench like this. Sit down on the bench like this. And so this is not cross-legged, but some people find that it's nice to get really low to the floor, and they can sit this way, sitting on their knees with a bench above their heels and then sitting on top of this bench. And it's quite comfortable to sit this way. And you can get kind of the same effect by taking some of these round cushions called zafus and put it upright like this, and then put it between your ankles and then sit down on it like that. This is also a pretty comfortable way of sitting. Allison here, she sells these kinds of things. So if anyone wants to buy cushions or mats, she makes them available. So sitting cross-legged, one foot in front of the other. If you do this, you want to experiment with how high you sit. Some people find that sitting higher is helpful, maybe getting two cushions or getting a blanket to get more height. If you really tighten your hips, the higher you want to go. If you're really loose, then the lower you want to go. You want to find what helps you the most. Ideally, the height that allows you to get your heels, your knees down to the floor. If your knees are up in the air like this, then it's nice to get a cushion or something, a pillow to put underneath them so they're supported. So otherwise, they might get strained over time. Um, So the reason for this emphasis is so that you can sit upright with a straight spine. One way to help you get a good aligned straight spine is to take your two hands on either side of your hips onto the mat, and you can do this on the chair too, and push yourself almost off the cushion. Let your chest come up, out. Go on. On the floor, yeah. And so your chest comes up as you lift yourself up like this. Can you see okay the idea? Get the idea? And then as you let go of your hands, you let your shoulders roll back. And probably many of you found yourself sitting a little bit straighter this way. And perhaps it allows your shoulders to relax a little more if they're hanging more this way. Is that the case for some of you? So this get a little bit more aligned. And then with your spine aligned, you can do anything with your hands that's symmetrical. Both hands are doing the same thing. Some people like having their hands on their knees or their thighs, palm downs or palm up. Some people, the classic way in Buddhism is to have your hands together, one in front, just palms, in, one in the palm of the other. If you have your hands resting on your heels or your ankles, sometimes it pulls the shoulders forward. And so if you get a sweater or a pillow or something and make a little bit height so that your hands are held higher, it can take some strain away that the shoulders or the back of the neck that some people feel sometimes to get some height here. We sit with our eyes closed in our tradition. There's nothing sacred about that. It's okay to sit with the eyes open. But generally we recommend sitting with the eyes closed, just gently closed. And many people find they have some tension in their eyelids. And that's okay. Just don't worry about it. Just let it be there and let your eyes rest best you can. And it's nice to have your tongue resting against the roof of the mouth. And also it's said that if you tuck your chin down back a little bit, that controls the tendency for the mind to wander off in thought. Though you might not believe that if you try. If you're sitting in a chair, the recommendation there is that you don't sit cross-legged at all, but you sit with both feet going straight out with your knees at a right angle. What you don't want to have is your knees higher than your hips, because that tends to make it difficult for your lower back. If anything, you want to have your knees slightly lower than your hips. And some people actually like to get little cushions to sit on in the chair, so you have the slope is goes down towards the front of the chair, so they get a little bit extra support for the lower back. That's the basics about the posture. That makes sense? Or do you have any questions about that, about how to sit? We sit with our eyes closed. Some people prefer to keep their eyes open, in which case the instruction is to keep your eyes kind of half open, pointed down at 45 degrees, the kind of focus as if you were looking at a mountain far in the distance. If you're really sleepy in meditation, sometimes it's nice to open your eyes. Stay awake. Any questions about the posture? Some people's legs fall asleep when they sit, especially people who are new. And if legs fall asleep, then usually within a few weeks or a couple of months of regular sitting, the blood seems to find other routes through the legs, and the numbness stops. If small movements, small changes in posture sometimes can alleviate that. If you can change where the pressure is happening, sit higher up on your cushion or further forward on the cushion, or there's various things, small things you can do. Yeah. It's not weird. There are people who occasionally will rock when they meditate. But the if you're doing it intentionally because you're trying to avoid stiffening up or getting hurt, it might help in some ways, but it'll keep you from really getting deeply settled. The more still the body can be, the easier it is for the mind to get really still. So, but you also don't want your back to seize up. So we might look at your posture together at the end of the class or something. It might be that finding just the right posture can help. And then learning what muscles can be relaxed. I had for a period of my meditation career a very bad back, and sitting actually helped it, because I would get in a very good upright aligned posture. And then I would relax the muscles all around my waist, stomach, and the top of my thighs and my lower back. And by the end of the sitting, the pain had been relieved. So that was my, there are different ways in which backs are trouble people, but for my back, that's what helped. So maybe I can look at your posture and see. So if that's all clear, then how we're going to start our first meditation is by doing standing meditation. After all that talk about sitting, right? And partly because I want to make the point that meditation can be done in any posture, and standing is one of the classic postures in Buddhism for meditation. And you might find lots of opportunities in your life to be standing, and standing in line. And it might be very interesting to know that this is a you're standing in a classic meditation posture when you're standing. And maybe you could use it for a little bit of mindfulness practice. So why don't you all stand? Then place your feet carefully under your hips, so the feet are about hips distance apart. Feel stable, and then close your eyes. And take a few moments to feel the contact of your feet to the ground. And then very slowly kind of lean forward with your weight. And then lean backwards, more weight than on your heel. And then try to find a place where the weight is balanced on the foot. And if you're very sensitive to your body as you're standing here, you might find that the body is constantly in motion, very small movements, very small little corrections happening almost automatically. That's completely fine. In a very simple way, become aware of what is happening in your body, and what it feels like to be in a body as you're standing here. If your knees are locked, you can relax your knees a little bit. And then standing here, take a two or three slow, long, deep breaths as a way of connecting to your breathing, getting to know it. And then let your breathing return to normal. And continue to be aware of your breathing. Be aware of your body. Feeling what effect the breathing has on your body as you breathe. How your body moves, changes. See if it's possible to relax the thinking mind. So the thinking mind is at ease. Or at least so it's in the background. So in the foreground, you're staying with your body and your breathing. It's perhaps helpful to think of mindfulness as a process of discovery, as opposed to the process of attaining something or getting something or going somewhere with a meditation. Simply discovering what your experience is like, discovering who you are in this lived moment right now. You can open your eyes and then very quietly take your sitting posture. Take a good, comfortable, aligned posture. And then gently close your eyes. And once again, take a few moments now. Just feel your bodily experience. How does your body experience itself right now? Within the body, as part of the body, become aware of your breathing. It can be helpful at the beginning of a session of meditation to take two or three long, slow, deep breaths. Help using the breathing to help you connect with your body. And as you exhale, letting that help you relax, let go. Tension, thoughts. And let your breathing return to normal. There's no right or wrong way to breathe in mindfulness. A Just breathe whatever way it's happening. It's also helpful at the beginning of a sitting to take a few moments to scan your body to see if you can, if there's any obvious places of holding that you can let go of. Sometimes the forehead can be relaxed. The eyes can be softened. Some people carry a lot of tension in their jaws. Can be helpful to soften the shoulders. Maybe next time you exhale, let the shoulders soften a little bit. And it can be particularly useful to relax the belly muscles. To let your stomach hang forward. It might help your breathing kind of drop a little bit deeper into your torso. And then within your body, as part of your body, become aware of your breathing. Become aware of how your body experiences the breathing. If you have trouble being aware, finding your breathing, sensations of breathing, you can put your hands on your belly or your chest and feel the movement there. Now our thinking mind often has a lot of momentum, a lot of strong habit of galloping off, thinking about whatever it wants. And it takes a while in meditation to retrain the mind, to not be so always so interested to run off with every thought that arises. But to let the thoughts go by themselves. When you find yourself lost or caught up in your thinking, gently let go of that. Relax the thinking mind. And begin again with your breathing. Again with your breathing. And since the thinking mind is so strong for many of us, there's a little way of helping the mindfulness by using the thinking mind in our favor. And that is very softly, gently, so whisper in the mind, name or label each breath. The in-breath can be labeled with the word in, the out-breath out, or perhaps some people prefer rising as the chest or belly rise, falling as it lets go and releases. Very gentle whisper in the mind, to help you stay focused, pointing the mind to stay with each breath, one after the other. There's absolutely no need to judge your meditation practice. Just like whenever your mind has wandered away and you notice it, relax the thinking mind and begin again with your breathing. And the idea is to hang in there with the breath. Sustain the attention one breath after the other, feeling how the breathing affects your body. What kind of changes occur in your body as you breathe? If you can relax into the breath, with the breath, staying conscious of each breath, one breath after the other, the rhythm of breathing over time, the breathing can have a wonderful effect on you. If you hang in there with each breath and allow it to affect you, it'll probably be for the better. The exhalations are partly a letting go. Letting go of the full extended in-breath. Each time you exhale, there's letting go. Let go of any thoughts and concerns you might have. And just be there with the breathing as simply as you can, trusting the breath. At the beginning of a session of meditation, it's often helpful to have a little settling in procedure. Maybe like how I described earlier, take a few deep breaths and scan through your body and relax whatever tension you can. It's equally useful to have a little procedure, a way to come out of meditation so that you don't just simply pop out of it when it's over. And one of the things that's useful to do is to take a few moments to be conscious of what this meditation session has been like. To bring to a greater awareness what this sitting for the last few minutes has been for you, hopefully without any judgment, kind of a process of discovery or recognition. Oh, I was sleepy mostly, or oh, I was concentrated on the breath, or oh, I was not that so concentrated. And then once you've done that, then in your own way you can take a couple of deep breaths, and when you're ready, Open your eyes. So the most basic foundation for Buddhist meditation, for mindfulness practice, is to begin with the breathing. And even though it's the foundation practice, it's also understood in Buddhism to be very profound practice in its own right. And some people, some Buddhists, will make it their only meditation practice, is just meditate on the breath. Even though we'll continue and talk about other forms of mindfulness next week, some people find that it's really helpful for months and years just to cultivate very strong, stable mindfulness of the breathing. And some of you might want to choose to do that for a while before moving on too quickly to other aspects of mindfulness. It's very profound, the breath. It's a great opportunity in the spiritual life to connect to the breathing. The connection between the breath and the spiritual life is seen in the very word spiritual, which spirit comes from Latin spiritus, one of the meanings of which means breath. Like to respire comes from to breathe again. Inspiration comes from the same root, spiritual. Spiritual inspiration has breath in both words. Isn't that nice? The breathing is very important. So how was that for some of you? What would you like to say about that? Little frustrating? Say more. So two things: his back got tired, and his mind wouldn't shut up. It is important to develop good sitting posture, good sitting habits, postural habits, and maybe we could work on your posture and find a better way of sitting. But also, some people spend a lot of their time not sitting in a very balanced, aligned way. And if you try to do that, sit upright by yourself for a while, you have to deal with weak muscles who get tired by holding yourself up, or chronically tense or held muscles, which get revealed in this process of sitting up. So sometimes there's a period of adjustment as the body adjusts to this new posture, and hopefully you stay encouraged by that process and don't realize it's part of the process. You can always sit in a chair if you need to. And the mind was, you said the mind was out of control?
Yes.
How many of you thought your mind was out of control? That's all? It's pretty common, and it's said that the first stage of meditation is the stage of realizing the mind is out of control. So some of you already reached that stage, congratulations. Some of you are still catching up, or beyond that. In Buddhism it's said it's much better to know that your mind is out of control than to have an out of control mind and not know it. So your mind was just as out of control before coming here than before. But there's some tendency when you sit down and be quiet that this becomes and trying to be in the present moment, it becomes a reference for noticing how busy the mind is. And so to realize how busy and active the monkey mind is part of the process of waking up. And rather than judging that and saying, oh, I can't meditate, I'm doing this terrible thing, you're actually beginning to discover something about yourself. The analogy I like to use for this: if you go up to maybe a mountain brook, a little stream, that's flowing along very quietly, it's very shallow perhaps, and you look at it, and you're looking at it, you can't tell whether the river's flowing or not. Maybe the water's sitting still, maybe it's not flowing at all. It's so clear. But then if you take a stick, and you put that stick into the river, upright, straight into the water, then a little wake is formed at the edge of the stick, and you can see, oh, in fact, the stream is flowing. And until you had that reference of the stick, it's hard to see whether the stream is flowing. Our life works in the same way. Unless we have some kind of reference for the momentum and movement of our minds and hearts and our emotions and feelings, sometimes it's very hard to see what's actually going on for us. And part of the function of something as simple as breathing, sitting quiet and being still and being with the breath, is it becomes that stick in the middle of our busy stream of our life. And if we're caught up in being busy and doing 10,000 things at once, Sometimes we don't even know we're so busy. We don't know the mind is so preoccupied and concerned with 10,000 things until we try to stop it or be quiet. And the meditation is working if you see the momentum, if you see the current that gets created. It's much better, as I said, it's much better to see that than let it continue and not be seen. So welcome to the first stage. Any other comments or reflections or questions, please? Yes. Yeah. So she found that she tends to slouch when she sits for a while, and then she's constantly making adjustments. And it's best not to to make a lot of adjustments with your posture once you started a session. Maybe two or three times is okay, but to make a lot of them keeps your mind is kind of active then. If you want your mind to really get still, it helps keep the body still. So it's okay to slouch. In Burma, meditators get fully enlightened meditating like this. You know, so it's fine to do that. It's just not good for your back. And the Buddha had a bad back. So maybe no one told him how to sit properly. Didn't have an ergonomic specialist. And but there's a balance between having some strength in postures and having being relaxed. And finding that balance sometimes takes a while. And it takes some effort to maintain an upright posture. And some people associate meditation with getting relaxed. They say, oh, I can't make any effort, I'm supposed to relax. But actually, you need to find the right balance between relaxation and effort, or kind of a tone, you know. So don't be afraid of holding yourself up, even though it might feel a little bit awkward at first. Some kind of inner strength gets born from that. But if you find yourself collapsing a lot, after a while, just collapse and just hang out, meditate that way. I think that it's best if the lower legs are perpendicular to the floor, coming straight up. And classically, the instructions to have your legs parallel to each other. Though I like, when I sit and meditate in a chair, to have my legs out a little bit. I feel more stable that way. Yes?
When I concentrate on my breathing, I have a tendency to want to breathe correctly, meaning that the stomach come out as you inhale.
Yeah.
Sometimes whether that takes away from the relaxation of just letting it breathe, let the breathing be natural rather than trying to control it.
It could be. So the kind of pure instructions for mindfulness meditation is for you to make no effort, special effort at all, in how you breathe. Don't try to breathe in the right way. Don't try to avoid the wrong way. Just breathe. And what we're cultivating here is not a particular way of breathing, but rather we're cultivating the awareness of breath. We're using the breath as a vehicle to develop our awareness. And that development of awareness can happen with the most controlled breath in the world. So usually don't worry about it. Don't make any special effort. Some people, however, more pragmatically, will find they spend a lifetime with certain unhealthy habits around their breath, a lifetime of holding their stomach tense. And then sometimes it's useful as a little pragmatic aid to spend a few weeks trying to intentionally change that habit and relaxing into the breathing. But you don't have to make a big deal of it. You don't have to if you don't want to.
My hang-up may be I once read a whole book on correct breathing.
Yeah.
It was written by somebody in India.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And here in California, I mean, people in California are supposed to have a long, deep breath, right? I mean, if you're cool, you have to have a long, deep breath. I mean, who wants to have a shallow breath in California? But there's no, you know, from mindfulness point of view, just breathe the way you're breathing. and just become use that as a vehicle to become aware of your breathing. Don't get caught up in how, you know. And if you do control your breath, some people do it automatically. They can't help it. And they think, oh, I can never do meditation. I can't be a spiritual person because I'm controlling my breath. In mindfulness, we couldn't care less if you control your breath. I know it's uncomfortable. It just, then you become the world-class expert at what a controlled breath feels like. It's mindfulness. We're trying to become aware of how things are. And if how things are as you're controlling your breath, you get to know that. And it'll change with time. It'll change faster if you're unconcerned about it than if you get uptight about having a controlled breath. Yes. Great. Beautiful. Great. Are there questions or concerns or? It's very common. And the monkey mind has a lot of momentum to it. So if we spend a lot of time in daily life chasing after thoughts, obsessing about things, then it's very hard to stop that cold. The momentum still continues. And part of what we have to confront in meditation is the fact of this momentum. And then not to try to add more momentum to it. If we get angry for having a monkey mind, we've just kind of fed the monkey another banana. It's the monkey mind. And the best thing is not to be bothered by it. Just be very accepting and very compassionate. Oh, this is what's going on. This is my momentum. And the best that you can for right now, just relax and come back to your breathing. If 10,000 times in the sitting, your mind wanders off, the only thing that matters is 10,000 times you come back to your breath. And every time you come back to your breathing, it's a little training in learning how to let go of obsession. And with enough drops, the bathtub is filled. With enough little drops of, enough little letting go, you're developing that capacity not to be so obsessed with your thoughts. And don't underestimate the value. It might not seem like it's very much, but the mind is actually quite malleable, amazingly malleable. If you consider a lifetime of a mind doing whatever it wants, out of control, the monkey mind, how quickly mindfulness actually can turn all around, given the number of moments you've been lost. I don't know if I said this, but the fourth week of the course, we'll talk about mindfulness of thoughts. So then we'll address that much more directly, thinking. So another hand? Yes.
Oh, I was thinking, I know from other things, not just similar to this, but it seems like having a person at the front who's telling me what to do helps me do it. And then if I go home and do it, it's not.
Right.
Wouldn't
experience. Yeah. Yeah, some people have that experience, and some people find it amazingly irritating to have someone speaking during meditation. So it can be very helpful to have some guidance. Some people listen to tapes, meditation tapes, and some people listen, they like guided meditations for that reason. But it's kind of like meditating with training wheels, because someone's prompting you to stay focused. And really, in order to become free, develop the meditation to its full potential, you have to be able to do this for yourself. And you have enough interest and dedication and presence and strength of mind not to have to rely on anything external to keep you focused. So you don't have to use music or nothing, just you. You can do it on your own. And so right now, today was training wheels, and hopefully at some point you can. And so it is harder at home. That doesn't mean that it's worse at home. It's probably more useful for you to develop your strength without me, even though your meditation is not so focused. Does that make sense? So, this five-week course works best if you meditate at home in the week in between our meetings. And I think it'll make a lot more sense, the instructions and the way it builds, if you're actually trying this out at home. And what I recommend if you're new to meditation is that you meditate at home for this week 15 minutes a day. and find 15 minutes you can do. The classic time, most classic time for meditation is first thing in the morning after you get up. There's some idea that the day is fresh and you're somewhat refreshed yourself from having slept, and the phone's less likely to ring and get busy. And though some people find that it's better, they prefer to sit in the afternoon or in the evening or before going to bed. It doesn't really matter as long as you sit every day for 15 minutes. And it's also helpful if you choose a place in your house where, in your home, where that's your meditation spot. So like maybe it's the only thing that happens there, like a little corner of your bedroom perhaps, or some place you can close the door. So when you come to that place, you're associated with your meditation. All associations are there. So it's easier to kind of enter into that mode because of that association. And it's best to wear loose clothing when you sit. It's nice to have a timer of some sort to tell you when 15 minutes is up. Because some people will find that after 10 minutes, they think, gee, you know, it feels like an hour. I can't stand it. And some people will say after 15 minutes, you know, wow, it just like was a minute. You know, I think I'll sit here for another, you know, it can't possibly be over yet. But have a timer so you don't have to think about it anymore. And find some timer that's innocuous, doesn't bother you, that doesn't tick, tick, tick or something. Some people I know have like to have meditation bells go, you know, to end their meditation session. So they will get a tape recorder and tape 15 minutes of silence. At the end of the 15 minutes, they'll ring a bell. And then when they meditate, they stick their meditation tape in, and stereo blasts out silence, 15 minutes, and then you hear ding at the end. So there's various ways of doing it. The other thing I'd like to encourage you to do during the week in between is not only do the breath meditation during your 15-minute sitting, but begin in some interesting, some curious way to discover what your breathing is like in different daily circumstances. What is your breathing like when you're driving? Or if you're driving in a hurry sometime, how's your breathing then when you're driving in a hurry? How does it change? What's the difference between breathing your breath when you're in a hurry driving versus when you're relaxed driving? What is your breathing like when you're sitting at your desk, if you're sitting at a desk a lot or something? And how does your breathing change in the course of the day? How does it change when you know you're going to be talking to someone or standing in front of a group of people to give a talk? Or if someone is angry with you, how does that affect your breathing? If you're angry, how does it affect your breathing? The breath is a phenomenally useful door into understanding something about the depth of who we are, our intentions, our reactions, our motivations, our emotions, even our thoughts. And as you become more sensitive and aware of the range of things happening with your breathing, you also become aware of how the breath is held at different times of the day. And if you can become aware of how it's held, then you have the option perhaps not to hold it anymore. And as the breathing becomes more conscious and more kind of fluid, you'll find that it lubricates your day. It's a lot harder to stay angry in some unhealthy way if you let your breath relax and breathe in a fluid, conscious way. But if your breath is held when you're angry, that's more likely to fuel you to stay kind of caught up in your anger. I just use that as one example, but it could be anything. So my suggestion is this during this next week, your homework is to get interested a little bit in your breathing in different circumstances and kind of see what that's like and see what you can discover and all that. So I think that's all I have to say. Do you have any questions? We have a couple of minutes before the end. And what I'd like to do, if you're be a little bit patient here, is to end with a short sitting. And a little guided sitting for those people who like it. And those who don't. Yes.
I have a mundane question. What time does this start out at
7? Yeah. Right. We switched. It used to be for many years at 7. We were in Palo Alto. But in moving here to Redwood City, we switched it to 7:30. So that's why people are still confused. So I apologize for the confusion. So it's 7:30 to 9. And we'll just try to do a very short sitting. So sit upright in an alert posture. It also maybe feels relaxed. Softly close your eyes. And take a couple of long, slow, deep breaths. Let your breathing return to normal. And then pay careful attention to the difference between how your inhalation feels in your body compared to the exhalation. Now, there are different sensations that make it up, different kinds of movements. And then see if you can notice which is least clear to awareness, the in-breath or the out-breath, which is least distinct, or which is more difficult to stay aware of, the in-breath or the out-breath. If either the in-breath or the out-breath is less distinct or more difficult to pay attention to, it's possible that that's the most likely place where your mind will wander off into thought. An idle mind will get lost in thought. And if you know this, if you notice this pattern, if there's a certain place in your breathing where your mind tends to wander off, then you have to remind yourself when you come to that point in your breathing to hang in there with the breathing, to get through that part in a mindful, connected way. And then finally, the practice of mindfulness is very closely related to the practice of acceptance, certainly of accepting yourself as you are. And as we end this sitting, see if you can extend to yourself as thorough and complete acceptance of yourself as you are right now. A friendly acceptance of yourself. As if you're your own best friend and you're so happy to see yourself. And then take a deep breath or two, and when you're ready, you can open your eyes. Thank you all very much, and good night.